I have no idea if I started it on or off. Okay, that looks like it started.
Hi, my name is Jesse Fishbein, and today we are going to talk about, we have a double session. So the first session is about Tara HaMishpacha, or the laws of marital purity, ritual purity, and the second part is about Tznius, or modesty. So I guess I'll give a small overview. Hello. A very, very small introduction, and then we can make it really question and answer and leave the door open to you can ask about questions that you have. And hi. And we'll see where we want to go. So this water bottle is so giant. I'm just going to put it down so I can see it. All right. So the laws of... I'm not really going to go into the laws unless anyone has specific questions about the laws. I actually have taught many, many kalas the laws, so I know the laws. Actually, being married, I keep the laws. So I do remember back when I was a kala and I learned some of these laws, and I called up my soon-to-be husband and I said, well, these laws are ridiculous and I'm not keeping them. Some of them I was willing to keep, and some of them I thought were absolutely absurd. And he said to me, Jesse, this is halacha. We're going to keep the halacha. And I said, So, but anyway, it doesn't end up being so bad, and it has a lot of benefits. We can talk about the specifics of the laws if you want. But I think in general, I just want to talk about a little bit about the philosophy behind it, the emotional aspects of it, and then we'll open up to questions. I think the laws of Tara Mishpacha are to me a really great example of the commandments in general. Just if you're looking for a paradigm for what is the point of the commandments, this is such a nice paradigm, the laws of ritual purity, because it has a benefit to the marriage, and it also has a benefit to the person individually, to your soul or to your personality. And a lot of the commandments, they have that dual aspect to them, like they're good for the community at large, or they're good for the world, and they also affect the individual. Like if you think of, let's say, charity. Charity has the benefit of helping other people, but the real benefit is that it affects you as a human being when you give charity. So it's sort of like that dual thing. It benefits everybody and it benefits yourself, which is one of the great things about Judaism, about Torah, that it's one of those what we call Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. It's this world and the next world. Everybody's happy. It gives you benefits for the world now. It gives you benefits to your soul, to the future, to your eternity. It's everything's great. So, I mean, of course, it has its drawbacks also. Okay. Any of these commandments have the drawbacks of needing discipline and self-control, which is very irritating. So, but aside from that, I mean, that's part of the benefits also. We'll talk about that. So, insofar as, I don't even know where to start. Do we start with the benefits of the marriage, or do we start with the benefits of the soul? I guess we'll start with the practical benefits of the marriage. So I'm married about 15 years now, and the first few months, every time I got my period, I cried. Because when you're a newlywed, you don't want these separations. So the basic idea of these Taras Mishpacha is that the husband and wife have to be separated for half of their married life, practically. If you're having a regular period once a month, so from the time you get your period until the time you go to the mikveh, you're separated from each other physically. So that is excruciating when you're a newlywed. And it seems like, what is the point of this? And this is ridiculous, and I hate this. And if you're a young newlywed who's a little immature, then it's even worse. So I remember we counted wrong when I got married, and you're supposed to work it out so that you get your period. If you're a virgin, then you get your period right away, right after the wedding night, because when you bleed from the virgin blood, you have to separate anyway, so you may as well get the period right next, and then, but I miscalculated completely, and I ended up, by the time I was ready to go to the mikveh that night, I got my period, so then I separated another 5 days, another 12 days, we're separated almost a month, and everyone's calling us up, how's married life? and we're like, it's a sick, hellish torture is what it is. It's crazy. So, but that, I would say, is not the general rule, but somehow you got to calculate right. So this separation in the beginning was very challenging. But then you get later into your married life, and you're tired, and you have kids, God willing, and then it's an amazing psychological phenomenon that the second you're separated, it's like your libido turns on. So it rejuvenates the marriage. And the Gemara talks about this. The Gemara in Tractate Nida, I think it's Rabbi Meir, he says, why did the Torah make a separation for 7 days? Because a man and woman, they're married to each other, they get used to each other, and the language is, they get disgusted by each other, v'katzba. That they're like sick of each other. And the Torah says, let them be separated for 7 days, and then they'll be as beloved to each other as they were underneath the chuppah. So that's sort of, it's a very practical, pragmatic, romantic aspect that it rejuvenates the marriage, and it's miraculously. And you figure after 2 years, after 2 years of marriage, I'm always amazed when they ask, and I guess it's not spoken about much, but how frequently do couples have sex when they're married? 5 years, when they're married 10 years, when they're married 20 years? And basically you find that the Orthodox people who are married, who are going to the mikvah, they are definitely having relations regularly, because every time they come home from the mikvah, every time the woman comes home from the mikvah, there's this rejuvenation. Or as opposed to other couples can go sometimes months without physical intimacy. And you don't really have that happening in a situation where there's the separation and then the rejoining. So it really has an amazing impact on the marriage. And then, just in terms of the spiritual aspect that I was talking about, I just love the whole idea of the Torah has a unique attitude towards the physical drives. And you really see that that other religions and other philosophies, they always get, there's so much room for confusion in terms of what are the human instincts for and what are the human instincts about, the human / animal instincts, and are they good or are they bad or are they neither? And this is just like a very confusing question that many religions try to address. And whenever I talk about in Kala classes, if you take, let's say, the Greek culture, what's the Greek attitude towards physicality, would you say?
Everything goes.
Yes.
Freedom.
The freedom and everything goes. And even more than that, I would say it's sexuality is something to be worshipped even. Like when they have the naked statues and their gods, and their physicality is the be all and end all of their existence. They have the gymnasiums, all, if you look at the culture, and so that's one extreme where the physicality is everything and the purpose of everything. And then you have, on the other hand, more in our culture, like the Christian society, and what's their attitude towards the sexuality? Right, it's evil. Basically, they say it's evil, and ideally, if it were in an ideal world, if you could, you would not have any sex whatsoever, and that would be the ideal. So you could see that there's just so many ways to approach the question of human instincts and sexuality. And then you have the Torah, which is just so refreshing, which is, I mean, yeah, were you going to say something? No. So, and the Torah idea is, well, we have a body and we have a soul. So we're this dual-natured creature, and the body is very important. You need to nourish the body, you need to sleep, you need to have relations, you need to have food, all these types of things, but that is not the purpose of your existence. And the purpose of your existence is a higher spiritual purpose, and more abstract, and more thoughtful, and more, and it's just a more spiritual. But we must take care of the body, and this is very important. And when we're taking care of it, we should enjoy it. If we're eating to nourish ourselves, we should certainly have a nice meal, and we should appreciate it. And God designed the physical, what are they called, the drives, to be enjoyable when they're satisfied. And that's also a blessing from God, and that's something we appreciate. to enjoy nature, to enjoy our physicality, but also to realize that that is not our be-all and end-all and our main goal, but it's an enjoyment. So that's the basic approach. And because we're not animals, and because we're human beings and we have this capacity for abstract thought and for wisdom and for contemplating God, all of these things, because we have that, one of the things that separates us from the animals is our ability to control ourselves if the situation calls for it. And that's one of the things that I find so interesting about the sexual laws. The sexual laws and the food laws are very connected in terms of, like if you look in the Parsha, I'm trying to remember what Parsha it's in Vayikra, in, I feel like it's chapter 18 or 19, something like that. And it talks a lot about the law, the sexual prohibitions. And the sexual prohibitions are very frequently mentioned with the food prohibitions. And they're both considered under the topic of holiness, Kedusha. Because what makes us holy is our ability to be something more than animals. And the way that we relate to our physical drives is what takes us out of the realm of being an animal and into the realm of being a human being, being godlike. So, and it just always amazes me how sophisticated these laws are, that you have all of these laws that are all designed to guide a person. It's like a training program. It's almost like you're going in a training program, like, how do I be a human being? How do I be not an animal? And I remember I didn't used to know this when I was in college, and I was in sociology class, like 100 people, one of those giant sociology classes. And it was in Queens College, so they had these senior citizens who were allowed to audit classes. And they had a person, he always used to talk a lot in class, and he must have been Jewish but not religious. And one day he's going on and on about kashrus and how it's a physical benefit. And then he turns around and he points to me. I was newly married, so I had my hat on, so everyone knew, anyone who knew who was Jewish knew that I was Orthodox. And he points to me and goes, but she disagrees that it's a health issue. 200 eyes turn to look at me, and the professor says to me, would you like to explain? And I didn't know. I was so upset that I didn't know. I didn't know. Well, I knew we don't keep kosher because it's health benefit, but I wasn't really clear on what the benefits were. And I was so upset that I had a situation where there were 100 people in the room, and I couldn't defend this concept of these laws. I didn't even realize that there was a connection between the kashrus laws and the sexual laws. And then eventually, a couple of years later, I found out, and I said, oh, if only I found that out 2 years ago, I could have just said it. And not only that, you have to know how to say it. Like, you need to be able to say it in 3 sentences because you only have time to say it. But then it ended up, I was still in college, and we were sitting in, it was a much smaller situation. I was with 3 or 4 people, and the professor didn't show up, so we were in the cafeteria, and they bought some food, and they said to me, oh, is it kosher? So I looked, there's a little OU, it was on potato chips. I said, yeah, it's kosher. So what's this kosher thing anyway? Why do Jews keep kosher? I said, yes, I know the answer. So I said, it's really the sexual laws also. I said, it's really to train us to be human beings, to be more than animals, that before we give in to any of our physical drives, we stop and we evaluate the situation. We say, is this something that's permitted or forbidden? And if it's permitted, then we enjoy it. And if it's forbidden, then we control ourselves. And the process of doing this many, many times a day and in many situations, it affects us deeply, and we become a nation. You'll see, we become a nation that is skilled in the art of self-control, that we're used to self-control, and we're used to evaluating our drives before we indulge. Yes?
I didn't mean to interrupt.
All right. So then let me finish, yeah. And then it becomes sort of, we learn to use our free will, and it's a practice for us, and we become more than animals in that way. Yes.
Sure.
Ed calls, or do we want to keep your question?
Yeah. The that idea of learning to control that you said is key in this practice. What's important about learning how to do that? Why do you have to learn or show that you can have control over these things?
Okay.
I understand that you want to be separate to animals, and you know that's. But why is it important? I still don't understand.
Okay, so your question is, why is it important for a human being to be skilled or to have practice in the art of self-control? Why does Judaism demand that of us? And why does it not only demand that, but make two major areas of law for the sole purpose of regulating us into this habit? And that's a good question. Does anyone have any ideas before I say what I think? Just think about it for a minute. What would be, let's say, the benefits, the general benefits of being skilled in that?
I mean, if you kind of think extreme, you could get into a lot of trouble if you didn't have self-control in certain areas, you know? If you just let yourself go wild.
Right, that's true.
So there's a safety element.
Yeah, I think you'll find in general. I mean, anyone have anything to say? Go ahead.
I think you become more cognizant that this world is not just like your absolute playgrounds, that like you become more aware of, you know, that things have been given by God, or that, you know, not everything is for your enjoyment, purely for your enjoyment. Like, you have to be aware of other people. You need self-control, like, in society and in law, and same with spirituality, just to like sort of tame you in a sense.
Any other thoughts?
I guess thinking like along the same lines, it just helps you to appreciate what you have in a much stronger sense, I think. knowing that you could, you know, I don't know. I just think it might make you more appreciative of just stuff in general.
Okay.
Depending on what topic you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. It's very broad.
Mm-hmm. I kind of think it sort of works with just practical decisions you have to make in life as well,
mm-hmm.
in terms of community, in terms of family, in terms of money. You can't control basic things in life.
That's absolutely. I mean, pick any area.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't control your gut at that moment, sometimes your gut is right and sometimes your gut is terribly wrong. Sometimes it's amazingly accurate and you should listen to it, and sometimes it's completely off. And I think everyone has had that experience where your gut has just given you the right answer and your gut has given you the exact wrong answer, depending on the situation. And you have to be able to, before you go ahead with that, to be used to stopping and evaluating. If you have that skill, then that is a tremendously useful tool in all areas of your life. I mean, if you're in an argument with a friend, or your boss says something, people say something, things that trigger strong, powerful emotional responses all the time. And if you're used to going ahead with it versus if you're used to pausing and stopping and thinking what you want to do and then reacting, that's a different life. So it's a different existence. Is that where you were heading in that? Yeah.
I just don't know how I would have reacted if someone had said this is like makes me, you know, it helps us think and makes us above animals and able to. I think I would have been like, so I don't keep kosher, so I'm closer to an animal. I'm not
right.
able to control myself, or also I can have a discerning mind and make choices in life, but that doesn't have to mean that choice of keeping the family purity laws or the kashrut laws, like, that doesn't necessarily mean
agreed
anything.
Yeah, so now we're really getting a little off topic, but it kind of is. There's a difference between, I would say, the laws that God designed to keep these ideas cohesive
and through the generations. So God designed the Torah with the laws that the Jewish people are gifted with the responsibility of preserving the system, as opposed to, and the system is for all of humanity. I don't know if I mentioned this. I mean, this is something, a big theme of mine, which is that the Torah is not just for the Jews. The laws of the Torah are for the Jews. The concepts of the Torah are for humanity. And that's called the Or L'Goyim, that we're a light unto the nations. So the idea that we exemplify the concept of human self-control is something that all human beings can relate to. We just exemplify it in very specific formats that we can preserve it through the generations. So there's that aspect of it. And there was one more thing I just wanted to say, one idea. Really, I guess we'll probably talk more about this on Pesach, or closer to Pesach. But it's a fascinating irony that this, the concept of freedom, freedom really comes through self-control. That if you're not able to control yourself, if you're a slave to your drives, then you really can't make any progress as a human being. That the first step towards freedom is really, it's a prerequisite. Before you can make real spiritual progress, you have to not be enslaved by your physicality, by your drives. You have to have the freedom to say, I can control myself if the situation calls for it. That's just a prerequisite. It's not, if you just have the prerequisite and you don't make any spiritual progress, then these laws haven't really helped you. I mean, just to be self-controlled for its own sake, so what did you accomplish? You accomplished that you have a tame society, but in terms of making real spiritual progress, that's the next step after self-control. Okay, so that was my general intro. Now, what aspects of Taras Hishpacha would you like to discuss or bother you or anything? Yes?
Okay. So there's the physical aspect, but where does touching become an act of impurity? Where does Anita? I mean, I understand it, but I want to get more into that.
Okay.
Because I can imagine that's difficult.
What?
Not being able to pass items.
Right. That's really the least of everything. That was the part, that was when I called my husband and I said, this is ridiculous. The passing thing was just so ridiculous to me. But it turns out that the hard part is no sex. That's the hard part. And the second hard part is no touching, no hugging, no kissing. Now, once you master those, to not pass is not really a big deal. So that's the least of our problem. But I do find it's very, very interesting. The rabbis were very wise. In terms of the actual law being that the way it works is that once a woman gets her period, until she goes to the mikvah, she's considered the status of nida. And you can't have sex while you're a nida. So, and the way that you remove the nida status is by immersing in the mikvah. So from the time that you see blood until the time you get to the mikvah, you're a nida. And you don't have any sex. And all these other laws also. There's also the no passing and the no touching and those kind of things. What's very interesting is that the rabbis, so that the law of no sex, that's a Torah law, not a rabbinic law. And the no passing is a rabbinic add-on. And very interesting that the rabbis created with their extra laws, there's a basis for that in the Torah, because in the verse, which is, like I said, I think in Vayikra chapter 18 or 19. It says, in all the other places, when it talks about the sexual prohibitions, it says, don't have sex with this person, don't have sex with this person. With regarding Anita, it says, don't come close to having sex with this person, with Anita. So because it says, don't come close to having sex, the rabbis inferred from that there's something called harchakos, things that add-ons, like fences, boundaries. So that's the source for all of these extra add-ons. So, and what the rabbis did is that they created an incredible a boomerang, almost, of intimacy and no intimacy. So what ends up happening is that you have, and I found this a beautiful idea that I heard. I don't know if you know the song, how does it go? Gila, Rina, Ditza, Chedba, Ava, Achva, Shalom, Bereus, that you sing at weddings. It's one of the Sheva Brachos. If anyone knows any tunes, how does it go? So one of the, so it says Gila, Rina, Ditsa, Vechedba, Avachva, Veshalom, Vereus. So that's the, those are, yeah, so it's eight different words for relationships. So Gila is joy, Rina is rejoicing, Ditsa is rejoicing, Chedva is romantic love. So those four, the I think it's the Maharal, he says that those four, rejoicing and joy and Gila, Rina, Ditsa, and Chedva and romantic love, are all languages that refer to the sexual aspect of the relationship. Then the other four are Ava, Achva, Shalom, and Reus. Love, Ava. Achva is brotherhood. Shalom is peace. Ava, Achva, Shalom, and Reus is friendship. Those four are not for when you're sexually involved. They're for the other 2 weeks when you're not sexually involved. And that's another practical aspect. You would not believe how much conflict being a nidah causes. It's the man tends to separate himself from you emotionally because he can't indulge himself physically, so he'd rather go off and watch TV. And that means that you're not going to bed at the same time, which is, can be benefits because it's finally like, okay, I get to go to, like, my personally, my husband likes to go to sleep very late and I like to go to sleep very early. And when you're romantically involved, you have to deal with the logistics of that. But when you're not romantically involved, everybody gets to do their own thing, which is great, except that then there's like this emotional separation. We're not connecting, we're not talking to each other, we fight a lot more. I remember I used to talk to, I had an email buddy, and I'm like, we got into this fight. She goes, are you Anita? Yeah, you're right, I am Anita, because the tensions are higher, because you don't have a sexual outlet. So as much as it's great for the relationship, it's also a little trying on the relationship, but that is a benefit, because you have the opportunity to work on love, ava, ach, brotherhood, friendship, and peace, and all those things without the physical getting involved. And you have, it's sort of like an opportunity to really deal with those issues, and because there's, and the laws, those other laws, there's a sense of intimacy with you wouldn't believe how romantic passing becomes, which is absurd, but it's sort of like it's an intimacy now because you can't do it half the time. So and then there's an eating together on the same table, all these things become much more laden with romance. So the rabbis sort of, in effect, they created this romantic aspect half the time and more of a separation half the time to work on other aspects of the relationship. Okay, so is that your question? Did I deal? Well, you wanted to know, actually, I didn't answer your question. Your question was, why is anidah cause impurity, right? Mm-hmm. So I would emphasize, this is my sense, I don't believe that menstruation causes impurity. That's not the Torah idea. I think that my sense was always just that something that happens every month is a woman's period. So it's a great natural, and it also is, getting your period is emotionally, has emotions associated with it and physical aspects associated with it. So there's often a time, I mean, I can really see in terms of postpartum where there's blood, there's certain, a woman wants to separate a little, she wants to be on her own, and then when there's no blood, she's more inclined to be together. So you have that with although I would say with your actual period that doesn't necessarily reflect the sex drive, but in general it happens to be that women's sex drive when a woman's ovulating is more, as a general rule. I wouldn't say, you know, in woman to woman, you could find that you have your period and you could be extremely sexually desirous, so it's not necessarily, but in terms of the Torah picking something to work with, that's a good thing that it, you know, it's useful. It happens every month. It gives an opportunity to work with that. That's another interesting point that I forgot to mention, is that you would think that with all these sexual laws, you can't have sex with this person, you can't have sex with this situation, that you would think that once you finally get married, that should be the free-for-all. But it's an additional layer of discipline that even within the permitted, there are times when you still have to control yourself, and that adds another layer to this training program that we were talking about. That even when it's a situation where you would think, okay, now it's a free for all, it's still not a free for all. There are still laws, and that helps with this training program that we were talking about. Okay. Yes.
So I'm really bothered by the extra rabbinic laws because obviously it's hard enough as is.
So, I mean, I understand generally why rat means not just in this case, it's in many cases that the rabbis, right. you know, build.
That's going to be the general answer, I mean.
Right.
The rabbis are they added on a lot of things.
Right. Is there any reason for it? I mean, 7 days is, like, quite significant.
The women added on the 7 days. The rabbis did not add on the 7 days. The Nashim Tzidkaniot, the righteous women, added on the 7 days. So, I'm a little not so great with the history, and I bet that there are other women who are more educated than I am who would remember the whole history. But I think, basically, there's two types of bloods that the Torah referred to. There's your period, which you have to wait, according to the Torah law, just 7 days, and on the seventh day, that night, you can go to the mikvah. And then there's this other thing called zava, which is a different type of emission, that because of those, you have to wait the 7 clean days. And it became very, very difficult to distinguish between the period blood and this other type of blood. So the women decided that they were going to take on the 7 clean days in all situations to make it easier. And that's what we did.
I can't believe the men agreed to such a thing. Maybe the women decided. Since when did the women decide?
The women took this. I really would have to look this up.
Yeah.
I feel not confident explaining the whole. I remember I looked through it 1 year, like 15 years ago or 20 years ago. I looked into it, but I really am hesitant to even say how all this. I need more information. Yeah.
I haven't really heard of the wise women, whoever they are. I'm sure that I know that it wasn't in the Torah these 7 clean days, but
well, it's in the Torah with regard to Zava.
What?
This other type of blood called Zava is from the Torah, you need 7 clean days.
But it doesn't say, and then Zava is just Zava, it doesn't say how many days
after Zava.
Zava means an emission.
So...
And some type of discharge. And there are 7 clean, and when you have a Zava, you must wait 7 clean days. But I don't know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
According to the Torah.
So
if you're not sure whether you're having menstrual blood or Zava blood, then you would be strict and wait the 7 clean days.
Okay. All right. So if it's based on that it's too hard to figure out the Zava, are there people who can figure out the Zava and they do that? Practicing in our community.
Well, not now, but I'm very hopeful that when Mashiach comes, that we'll get back to this.
But why can't... I mean, if it's just a matter of learning Zava...
I don't know. You know what? I'm really... Maybe I'm even wrong. Let's even pose the possibility that my facts are off, so we really shouldn't go down this path at all. This is something that I recollect from years ago, so...
But do you think there are women in this, say, this community of the Upper West Side who might not do that 7 clean days? They'll just do their own, whatever the Torah says to do?
I don't know.
Or is it like a standard
thing? No, it's a standard thing that it's 5 days and 7 days. Yeah.
5 days and 7 days, okay.
Yeah, as far as I know.
5 days.
5 days for bleeding, and then when you stop bleeding, then you can start counting your 7 clean days.
Is it 7 clean days of Sephardic and Ashkenaz? Because I heard like Sephardic maybe 6 or 5 days after bleeding.
No, I had at one point heard that maybe for the Sephardim it could be 3 or 4 or 5 days. It doesn't have to be necessarily 5 days, but everybody, as far as I know, maintains that you must be 7 clean. Everyone, as far as I know, again, I'm not well versed in Sephardi halacha, but as far as I know.
Can I ask, what about if you're on? I'm gonna have to learn all this stuff, but if you're on the birth control pill for whatever reason, is that does it start from the day that you get your? I'm getting very graphic now, but the day you get your period, or the day you start your? Like,
no, when you see blood. When you see blood, you become nida. Yeah.
Okay. Is it just a coincidence that it's almost 14 days? Well, that's usually when you can get together with your husband again. It's usually your ovulation,
right?
Makes it really. I feel like that's why there's so many children born so quickly in Judaism, which is great. But I mean, is that just coincidence or was that meant to...
I don't think it's coincidence.
Yeah, I don't think so. But I mean, just
yeah. I mean, assuming that you're a woman who has a 28-day cycle,
right.
If you're not,
then it may pose a problem, actually.
Yeah, there it could cause halachic infertility sometimes, mm-hmm. where women who ovulate earlier, and also sometimes for people who don't know when they're ovulating, sometimes you run out of steam by the time you ovulate, and you miss the ovulation unless you're tracking.
So what happens like then? In a circumstance of halachic infertility, I assume you can go to your rabbi and say...
Generally, the general approach is to use medication to push off ovulation in those cases.
Wow.
But sometimes you can squeak by, like I said, that maybe you can count less than 5 days before the seven, sometimes. But that's difficult. Yeah?
So obviously when you stop having periods, when you reach menopause,
right.
then you don't have this problem anymore, right?
You mean the problem of mikvah?
The problem of wanting to not touch or have sex.
Right. It's not, it's interesting that you're referring to it as a problem, because, like I said, it does cause a certain rejuvenation to the marriage, and it has tremendous benefits, mm-hmm. as much as it is annoying.
I'm thinking it will take several years to kind of realize that it's not a problem, that it's so beneficial. I think it's going to take time to figure that out, but I don't know how you can look at it as positive automatically.
Oh, I agree.
At the beginning, even keeping kosher,
kosher is
like
one of my most difficult
for me.
I grew up keeping kosher, and I am in so much pain over keeping kosher. I find it incredibly painful. I also find it very beneficial to me. Like, knowing what the benefits are, and I can almost feel my soul expanding every time I want something and I don't indulge. So I can feel that, but I do find it difficult to keep kosher still. And I, in fact, I find that I'm almost the exception. People who grew up keeping kosher are used to it, and they're used to having a lot, especially in New York, you have a lot of kosher food. But I've always felt this very strong desire to indulge myself, I guess. And whenever I'm away, or whenever I see things that I want to eat, I find it painful that I can't eat what I want. But I suppose that is the perfection. That's the benefit, that I don't indulge that. I'm more than that, because the Torah demands that of me. Now, if the Torah didn't demand that of you, if you were not Jewish, then is there a benefit to just depriving yourself? There's no benefit. But in terms of it being a paradigm for the concept of self-control, so that's the use of it.
The question was, when you get to menopause, you don't have to do this anymore.
Well,
right?
You go to the mikvah. So what happens is your last period of your life, you would get your period, then you would count your 5 days and your 7 days, you would go to the mikvah, and then you would wait to bleed again, and you wouldn't bleed anymore.
And then, okay, so if, God forbid, you had some problem and you had to have, like, you had a premature menopause, mm-hmm. or you had...
Or a hysterectomy or
something.
And
you have to have a hysterectomy mm-hmm. or something terrible, something like
right.
that. Then do you never have to do this ever after that, even though you're still mm-hmm. technically...
Yeah, it only is triggered, so to speak,
okay,
by blood.
Okay, so even if you have ovaries and even if you're ovulating, as long if you don't have any blood coming out, then
you wouldn't be ovulating.
Right, I don't see how you would ovulate if you don't have
you
your uterus.
Have your uterus out.
Right.
You would still ovulate if you've got ovaries.
I guess so. Then your uterus wouldn't be ready
and would never bleed
out. So then
right.
you would never need to go to the mikvah.
One reason to have a hysterectomy, just
dark humor.
Why not? I am curious about the penalties for the men who do have sex with Anita.
Okay.
Because from what I've learned about it,
the penalties
it's
are equal.
Heavy duty.
The penalties for men and women are equal. For having sex with Anita, the woman who is Anita and the man who has sex with Anita, the penalty is kares, to be cut off from the Jewish people. So it is a very, very heavy penalty. It's a good question of why the Torah chose such a heavy penalty. Bear in mind also that it used to be, before the time of King David, no. It used to be that women would always go to the mikvah from the time they got their periods. As a teenager, they would go to the mikvah.
And it then became the practice for women who got their periods not to go to the mikvah until they got married. So if you had women who were regularly going to the mikvah, who were single, who had relations, then that would not be the kares penalty. Because if you're having sex as a single woman who has gone to the mikvah, then what you're doing is you're violating a rabbinic violation, which is you're not allowed to... Actually, it may even be a biblical prohibition, which is don't be sexually promiscuous. It's called kadesha. Don't be sexually promiscuous, meaning don't have sex without marriage. But it's I think the penalty would be lashes. It wouldn't be the penalty of kares, which is a much more heavy-duty penalty. So
you're not supposed to go to the mikvah unless you're married?
So that would be a rabbinic prohibition. The rabbi said don't go to the mikvah until you're ready to get married.
What happens to a woman who is divorced or does she continue to go to the mikvah?
No.
Sometimes I've heard that in Judaism, once you start doing something, no matter what, you should continue doing that. Like if a woman is divorced or widowed, she should still cover her head.
Right. Covering your hair is a different issue, which perhaps in the second hour we'll address. I mean, we can talk about it now. I'm not going to be rigid. We can't talk about modesty until the second hour. But I would say in general, the law of covering hair sort of is triggered. It's like once you get married, you now are obligated to cover your hair. And it's because entering into the sexual relationship, you take on another aspect of modesty. Let's put it that way. So once you get divorced or once if you're widowed, so you're still a sexually aware being, so you would continue to cover your hair unless there would be a reason not to, like it would be easier to get married with your hair uncovered. So, but going to the mikvah is really so that you can be physically intimate with your husband. So if you're in a situation where you're not being physically intimate, then you wouldn't go to the mikvah. For example, if your husband was out of town, you wouldn't necessarily go until the night before he comes back. Even if you're finished counting your 5 and your 7 days, why would you go to the mikvah until he came? I mean, maybe you could if it was convenient, but as a general rule, I would say that women wouldn't do it until, like if your husband's away, back in the day, he's away for 6 months. He's traveling, he's doing a business trip. So you wouldn't go to the mikvah every month. You go to the mikvah, if you don't know when he's coming home, but you know he's away for 6 months. So then you wouldn't go to the mikveh until he were coming back.
Sorry. Okay. If you're on vacation, and it's maybe, a 2-week vacation or longer, and you're with your husband, but then you can't find a mikveh, isn't there...
You could pretty much, in America...
A body of water or something?
Yeah, a body of water is
exactly
actually...
how do you do that?
So yes, I've gone in the lake a number of times, actually.
Okay.
It's really annoying.
So you just find an ocean or a lake
and
say the bracha and...
Yeah, you need someone to watch you. Your husband can watch you, just to make sure you're completely submerged.
Okay.
And then you would clean yourself off. You really end up, you can't be too concerned about... People in the mikveh, they're always very concerned about being very, very clean.
Exactly.
But once you've gone in the lake, obviously my feet are walking in dirt from the time I get to the lake to dunking in the lake. So you get much calmer about the whole thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's basically what you do. I think I almost can't remember what I did because it was a bunch of years ago already. But I think what I did was I wore clothing and then loose clothing, and then I sort of just made sure that my body made contact with the water once I was underneath. So yeah, but the mikveh is really the essence of the mikveh is that it is a body of water. So it's sort of like the real mikveh is the ocean or the lake, and what we construct has to be connected to the flowing water.
So it's better to do that than to delay a few days until you find.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. It's always better to. People sometimes feel that they're being strict with. They're being strict with mikvah by, I saw some blood, and I won't ask the rabbi, I'll just stay separated. But to be strict with separation is to be lax about your marriage, I think. Because the goal is really to be together as much as possible, to pro-intimacy. Just excuse me a moment while I pop a knot.
Sorry, guys. Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
The thing about sleeping separate beds, what is that a law, or is that like something recommended?
So the thing about separate beds is obviously it only applies during the weeks when you're Anita. Mm-hmm. So when you see blood till the time you get your period, that's one of the separations. I think it's a rabbinic separation.
It's a rabbinic law.
Yeah, there are a number of aspects to it. Like it's part of what we call like the harchakos, the things that keep you away from. So right. No touching and separate beds. The bedding shouldn't touch. Now talking about intimate things, all of these things are to keep the intimacy on a lower key for that time.
Are you actually, can you be in the same room? Like, the two beds can be in the same room?
Yeah.
I think it's a really big, old school bed. Mm-hmm. Like a king size thing.
Going back to the penalties, I was reading a book. What's the book I wanted to sit on? Perdé's Family... Her days, probably on family purity, and it says the laws of Nidah fall on the woman to uphold them, and if you break them, it's a serious like breaking the kippur. Actually, break them.
Well, it's only because, like we said, that the Kari's penalty, which is being cut off from the Jewish people, is the same penalty if you eat on Yom Kippur. It's the same penalty. There are different punishments that are given by the Torah. So in general, the rabbinic punishments, if you violate something rabbinically, the penalty is, I think, rabbinic lashes. If you violate most of the laws of the Torah, it's lashes. Then there are some more serious ones, which are death penalty, and then there are the most serious ones, which are kares. You become cut off from the Jewish people. So
I've never heard of these penalties.
Well, right now we're not imposing the penalties because we don't have a court. There's no court system. So, but these are the penalties, like the Torah says, and whoever does this shall get the death penalty, assuming you have a court.
How do you reconcile that? Like, if you're a Baal Teshuva. Like, you've just learned about these laws, but then you violated them
your whole life.
Well, that's what Jew is for. That's what repentance is for. I mean, you're not expected to... If you're someone who didn't know the laws and you violated them, the whole point is that becoming a Baal Teshuva is that you're now... When you get to the point where you commit to keep the laws, and that should be a slow and steady process where you don't take too much on yourself and you don't go crazy... And like I was talking about before, if you take too much on too soon, you end up throwing away the whole thing. It's a very delicate process. You have to be very careful. You have to know yourself and be slow. So when you get to the point where you take on the law and you say, I'm never going to violate it again, at that point, you have done what you call tshuva on that particular commandment. And then you say that, and then you go through the confession where you did this and you violated it and you... Or sorry, you will not do it again, and then you're forgiven. Yes.
What about, as you said, take it slow, but during the process, I mean, you know, you're learning the laws, and you know you may not be doing something according to the laws, but you're not ready to do it, so...
I mean, I hope this is the same thing that you have been... It's the same approach in any commandment that you're beginning to take on, keeping Shabbos, keeping kosher... All of these laws, if you're working towards a goal of keeping the Torah laws, so you take it based on your knowledge of yourself and your learning and your motivation. That's the way
while
you do
you're
it.
Learning, you're still maybe breaking laws.
Well,
laws.
God understands that's the way human beings operate. Yeah.
That'd be right.
I don't know what you're going to say, but I thought anyway. So. Well, if you want to go to the mikveh and just do the 5 days and not take on the extra 7 days, even though I realize that's not law.
Well, it may not. Well, here's the thing. Since we can't distinguish between the zava and the nida, which are two different types of blood, and you are saying, oh, I'm going to go after the fifth day when I see no blood, but you needed to go after the seventh, you needed the seven clean days. So then you didn't end up going halachically to the mikvah, and you did not remove the nida status.
So the rabbis really have no idea what the zava is? Like, no one really?
I don't know.
It's just like this vague term.
Yeah. I have to look that up. I really am sorry. I hope I'm not giving any false information here. I really don't know.
Well, I mean, then there's the clocks you can, like, you check on that you can, mm-hmm. like, you can actually, like, show the rabbi to make sure that, like, what is...
Well, those clocks are just, those during the seven clean days.
Yeah.
And let's say we were doing it just the 7 days of the Torah. The period, let's say your period's 5 days, and then you would wait 2 more days of the just 7 days of the period, and then that night you would do a bedikah, and then if it's clean, then you go. A bedikah is just something that you do to check to see if you're bleeding. And for 7 days, you check to see if you're bleeding. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so back
to the
question.
It's really interesting because I know that for a rabbi to decipher if it's period blood or zava blood, whatever. Like I know.
Well, they don't decipher that. What they decipher on these white cloths is this. It's very interesting. It ends up being very technical, and you would say, "Why are we being so technical?" But let's take a sukkah. So it happens to be that a sukkah that's more than 20 amos high is not a sukkah anymore. So 19 amos, it is a sukkah. 21 amos, it's not a sukkah. So why that distinction? Because at a certain point, it's not a structure anymore. Something has to define it as a structure. So the same thing with blood also. Certain colors define it as blood that makes you a nida. So even though it may physically be blood, once it hits a certain range of color, which is like a brown, or, you know, there's burgundies, there's browns, there's oranges, there's all sorts of colors. So the rabbis have, it's not the rabbis, there is an actual masorah as to what is considered blood halachically and which is not considered blood.
Right. So I know that training actually takes years.
So that training, though, is whether or not it's blood, not whether it's zava blood or nida blood.
But isn't that kind of silly that a rabbi will actually sit for years studying that, but still yet cannot decipher between period blood and zava blood?
Okay, we have to stop. I don't even know if this is, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be like about you, but what if I'm wrong? What if that's not the reason for this gentleman to keep? Then we're assuming everything. I really have to do some research. I can't even remember who I asked this. I'm going to have to find out. So, yeah. Yes.
Okay, you mentioned that there was no court system, if you will.
Right now we don't have a Sanhedrin, a court.
Well, yes, so there's no Sanhedrin. However, now, like if a couple is getting divorced and they have to get a get. So
yeah, that's called a Beis Din, not a Sanhedrin, right?
So why is there a Beis Din for something that's so personal?
What, for getting divorced?
Well, yeah, I mean, because, why? Why?
That's such a good question.
Because you're dealing, a marriage is an intimate thing. When you're talking of your cycle, that's an intimate thing because it's personal. But then when you're talking about couples that are getting divorced and you hear of people who go to a Beis Din in order to eradicate their marriage and it becomes a very big deal.
What do you mean it becomes a very big deal?
It's very personal.
I mean, I'm not sure what you're getting at, and I'm just, the aspect, it says in the Torah, there's a pasuk which says that when a man and woman decide to get divorced, there's a law that a man must give a woman a certain document called a get.
Yes.
And if he, what? And if, right, so if he gives, and in order to give the get, there needs to be, it needs to be done through the courts. That's the construction of that law. So, and it's just to fulfill that law.
But then why does it be, you hear some cases where it becomes a very big deal, where somebody will not grant the get.
Right. My sister was in Aguna for 2 years at least, so I do feel very strongly about this topic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I mean, I just feel like there are some things that are very, like this, it's a very personal thing. And so it's funny that then there are other, as you mentioned, well, you can show the rabbi this, and you can show the rabbi that, and then I think, well, then, it's sort of like, why do you have to show a rabbi? Because it's such a personal thing. So I understand that people want accuracy, but I also feel like even in a case of getting a get or not getting a get, it's such a personal. It's your thing, I don't know. I don't. I think by ways of whatever the struggle is, I don't know. You just
each thing has its own, I guess, its own conflict.
Yeah, that's true.
Robin, with the gift theme, specifically with marriage and men not giving gifts or giving gifts, first it's to help the couple. So see if they really do need to get divorced. I mean, just sometimes they try to reconcile. The rabbis will try to help them reconcile. But with a get, men don't, like you were saying, I have several friends who have been stuck because the men refuse to give the get. And they need, the woman needs someone to advocate on their part. So it's not, at that point, it's really for protection. It's not really just, it's not just personal. It's not personal. It's someone, they're trying to help.
And also when you go, but when you go through a divorce, sometimes it could
yes.
be the happy, joyous two-way.
The romantic two-way, yes.
Yeah. So what can't you do in those 2 weeks?
Okay.
Let's just eliminate what we have to eliminate. We can do everything else.
So what can you not do? The general approach is that ejaculation should be inside. So inside the vagina. That's the general. I have heard that there are some rabbis who are even lenient on that, so perhaps a person could find some. But it may be if you found that very difficult and a major aspect of conflict in the marriage, there might be rabbis who would then permit it. Ejaculation, let's say, because through the stimulation of oral sex. In general, oral sex would be permitted, just not the ejaculation. So there are some, I'm trying to think what things would be actually forbidden. Any position is permitted. The lights have to be out. That's a very interesting thing. Only for the actual act, though. For any foreplay, you could have lights on.
Why? And what if it's daytime, though?
So for daytime, you would have to dim the shades. Dim the shades, actually. You'd have to dim the shades.
What happens when a couple doesn't want to have any more children? Can you use birth control, or it depends on like how religious you are?
The general rule is that there is an obligation on the man to have a boy and a girl. So that leads to a lot of leniencies, because there's leniencies for spacing, there's leniencies for if the couple emotionally needs more time or can't handle it. And then there's a rabbinic commandment to keep having children after the biblical commandment of having a boy and a girl.
What if you just can't financially, let's say?
Right.
You know,
so then it becomes a stress, and you would seek permission to stop.
Even if you, let's say, had two boys or two girls.
Right.
Okay. Or you stop feeding them.
Why does it have to be dark?
Modesty.
But why do you have to be modest?
That's an interesting question.
Having intercourse.
I know, isn't that interesting? I find that very
modest. Can
you know what? There is another law that I remembered. The man can't gaze at the woman's vagina when she's open. He can look to see what he's doing. He can't gaze. These are both modesty laws. That even in the course of and there's another one that I remember. You can't have sex while you're completely drunk, and you can't have sex while you're furious at each other.
Does that mean for when a woman's giving birth, if a man's in the mirror, he's not supposed to be standing facing the baby?
Right. If he wants to use a mirror to see, that's permitted.
Really?
So lights off, so that would be like dim?
No. When it's dark out, the lights have to be off. And it's really preferable for it to be dark, dark. But if you're in a situation where it's daytime, and the best you can do is to dim the shades, so then that's allowed. And also you can't have sex outside.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What?
I don't know. I'm wondering. It would be an interesting question. I had asked some. I call the rabbis on this because I teach, and people ask me these questions. Like, what about an airplane? What about an elevator? So, right. So here's the thing. I'm not sure if you're in a completely isolated spot, but you're outside. I haven't asked that question. That's an interesting, I'm not sure. Because if you're for sure isolated, and then I'm not sure if you're allowed. I think you might not be allowed. It reminded me of one more prohibition. What was it? Yes. There has to be a modesty that other people don't know you're having sex when you're having sex. Or that other people don't know that you had sex the night before. that's why people are private about when they're going to the mikveh. Now, in general, you don't have to get crazy with that by lying to say, and this happens to me, my daughter says to me, where are you going, mommy? So I say, out. Now, I don't do big, elaborate lies. I just say modestly, I'm going out, and either she understands or she doesn't. At this point, she probably figured it out. But, and also, if you're at someone's house and you're going to be late for the Friday night meal because you're going to the mikveh, I don't think that you need to make up a whole lie. You could just tell the person, your hostess, very privately that you're going to be, I mean, if you're close enough to, if it's like a good friend of yours, you could say, I'm going to the mikveh, I'll be late. You don't have to lie elaborately about it. Yes?
After you have a baby, how long do you wait until you either go to the mikveh?
Yeah, you have to wait till you stop bleeding, which is generally by 6 weeks you can go. But sometimes it's seven, it depends on the person.
So is it, like, once you start, stop bleeding, and then 7 days?
7 days, right, from the time you stop bleeding, yeah.
And when you're pregnant, you can have...
The whole time. Yeah, assuming you don't spot or bleed. I have gone to the mikveh when I was pregnant. Yeah.
Most of the time, I'm sorry, if you're nursing, I know for me it was, if you're nursing like full time and you're not having a period, then it's fine.
Right. I personally get my period when I'm nursing after by 6 weeks. Yeah. But if you're lucky.
I went like two and almost over 2 years.
So you're very fortunate.
Without.
Yep.
Yeah.
So if you spot, it starts all over again.
Okay, so spotting actually is very interesting. Now, the way it works is that we said before that it goes by, you become a nida when you see blood. So the question is, what is defined halakhically as seeing blood? So if you see blood on white, then even a spot is going to be defined as seeing blood, a certain size of the spot. It has to be a certain size, has to be a certain color. If you're wearing black underwear and you spot, is that a spot? It's not a spot.
It's not.
Not on black underwear. A flow is a flow. Like, you know, you have
right.
your period. If you're wearing black underwear, there's only so much time that you can pretend you're not flowing, and then you're flowing. So, but if you're spotting and you're wearing colored underwear, then you're fine. And that's why during the 7 clean days, you have to wear white underwear, because your body, you have to check to see if you're spotting.
If you don't have periods anymore, but you have some kind of bloody discharge, do you have to go to the mikveh?
So again, it would depend on, if you're wearing white underwear and it's a certain size, then it would be defined as blood bleeding, halachically.
It's not a period blood, it's just a physical blood.
Right, but any type of uterine spotting. If you know that your doctor prodded your cervix, then that's fine, you can ignore it. But if it's uterine, then that's a problem.
Back to the dark thing again. I know this is a modesty question we can discuss later, but does that also mean, I assume it means that you can't ever really view each other naked, like you can't shower together.
No. I just mean that the man cannot gaze at the woman's actual vagina when her legs are spread, but he can absolutely gaze at the rest of her body.
And you said it's just during the act of intercourse, not before.
What, when he gazes?
No.
Or the darkness?
The darkness.
Okay, darkness is only during the actual act of when... and the gazing is only an actual gaze. Well, some people might want to know this. I don't know. And gazing is only a long type of staring at the actual place, at the vagina. But an actual, like, looking and admiring and enjoying would be permitted. Showering together would be permitted. Now, it's going to get practically difficult. Let's say you're showering together and then you decide you want to have intercourse in the shower. Someone's going to have to go and turn out the light.
I don't know. So oral sex, does it go one way or can it go both ways?
Both ways.
How does that work? If it has to be turned off?
No. So oral sex, let's say you're not ejaculating. Because we said that the standard is that ejaculation should occur inside the vagina. That would be the general approach, unless for some reason that you found a rabbi who would permit it, which I said there were some, but I don't know of many.
I'm speaking the other way around.
So for what, a woman to have an orgasm? Do you want me to pause? What? So if he needs to look to see what he's doing briefly, so then he would do so. But that's different than gazing for sexual enjoyment.
Is he supposed to know this?
What? I assume that let me just pause. Okay, regarding the question of how frequently it should be done. So it's interesting that it goes based on the man's job. So the way it works is that men who were sailors who were away, I think they had to come back once a year and have sex with their wives, or it wasn't fair to their wives. Men who were, let's say, whatever other job where they had to come back once a month versus once every 6 months. And I think a scholar, a Torah scholar, has to have sex with his wife once a week. And I don't think that it was commanded more frequently than that. In general, there's a commandment that the man has to sexually satisfy his wife. And it goes by that when a woman wants it, the man is obligated to satisfy her. And if a woman doesn't want it, then he's really not permitted to have. So a wife, though, does need to be cognizant of her husband's physical needs and try to satisfy him. But in general, the obligation is on the man to satisfy the wife.
Are we forbidden to withhold it?
Are you forbidden to withhold it? I don't know that you're actually violating something, but you can easily cross the line into cruelty, I think. I mean, I think a lot of times women do use it as a tool, and it's not fair. And they also are not aware of how much men need it physically and emotionally, and so they're not sensitive to that. That's something that a woman should be sensitive to, I think. But I don't know that you're violating anything, just more the spirit of the marriage. Yeah. Any other questions? Is it possibly exactly 9? No, it's 8:15. All right, we have another hour.
I have a really stupid question.
Okay.